Before we begin today's show, Mesa, Arizona and Las Vegas, Nevada. There are a bunch of new listeners, and thank you for supporting. Thank you for listening. And if you are a listener in some other city, please be sure to tell a friend, because then maybe, just maybe, you will hear your city mentioned on Questioning Medicine. So without further ado, let's get to the episode. Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about. And today, yesterday, we are going to talk about an article. It's actually a guideline, maybe one of the few guidelines I will ever cover on this podcast. A guideline that will save more lives than any paper I've ever done on Questioning Medicine ever before. I think this is going to be episode 138 or 139, something like that. All other papers, maybe even combined, doesn't add up to this paper. It is huge. You're not going to want to miss it. So with that, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. And here we go. Andrew Bilt, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? We're just going to jump right into it. This article, this guideline that I'm talking about, the one that tops all other life-saving guidelines is Initiation, Pharmacological Treatment in Tobacco-Dependent Adults, an Official American Thoracic Society Clinical Practice Guideline. This is Volume 202, Issue 2, just recently published in May of 2020. So pretty hot off the press, and let's just be honest, everything that I talk about has very minimal global grand mortality benefits. If you can get your patient to stop smoking, that has a significant benefit. The number needed to treat on most medications that we give is somewhere approaching infinity when it comes to mortality. Sure, they may have better quality of life. Sure, they may have better numbers. But when it comes to mortality, most numbers, most treatments, most drugs, most things that we do in medicine don't really affect mortality. But smoking cessation, that does. So this is going to be an in-depth dive at these guidelines. I'm going to spend maybe the next 5, 6, 7 minutes on these guidelines because they are that important in my mind. If you don't think that smoking cessation is a big deal, that's okay. You're entitled to your own opinion. I don't agree with you, but you are entitled to it. And you will want to skip forward the next 6 or 7 minutes because this is going to be boring for you. It's just not your cup of tea. But I will tell you, there are some things in here that are practice changing. At least they changed my practice. So here we go. The ultimate takeaway is varenicline is first line. Varenicline, also known as Chantix, is first line. Now, I will say that this guideline was really well done. They used the grade methodology. They used a panel of experts that didn't have any big pharma, didn't have any contributions, didn't have any conflicts of interest. They even go in there and say that one individual did have a conflict of interest, but they pretty much kicked him out from being able to review or edit the whole process. So if you did have conflict of interest, you're out of there. Kick, kaboot, kabam. This was a really well done guideline. This is probably methodologically one of the best guidelines I've seen done in a really long time. Now, for tobacco dependent adults in whom treatment is being initiated, should we start with varenicline or should we start with a nicotine patch? As I said at the beginning, varenicline. But let's look at the answer. Let's look at the data. The data says that 40 more per 1,000 patients who are started on varenicline compared to a nicotine patch will have absence at 6 months of follow-up. When you put those into real numbers, that's basically 1 out of 20. 1 out of 20 people that you treat with varenicline compared to a nicotine patch will be nicotine absent at 6 months. What about bupropion? Often we use bupropion because we say, oh, varenicline, maybe it costs too much. Oh, maybe that you have some mental health issues. We don't want to use, we'll just use bupropion. We'll use it maybe a little off-label. Maybe you have a little depression at the same time. We'll do that. Well, if you are thinking about doing that, let's look at the data because the guideline addresses this. And they say, if you are giving varenicline, then 77 more patients or people per 1,000 that take varenicline will be tobacco-free at 6 months compared to individuals who are on bupropion. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, you heard it right. It's 40 more per 1,000 when you're comparing varenicline compared to a nicotine patch, and it's 77 more per thousand when you're comparing varenicline or Chantix to bupropion. That is approaching a number needed to treat of right around 1 in 15. Those are really good numbers. And you might be saying to yourself, well, Andrew, is that it? Just varenicline by itself? That's it? That's all we do? Well, not so fast. They do say, and they do recommend, that varenicline plus nicotine replacement therapy is superior over varenicline alone. The numbers bear out in 105 more patients who are on varenicline plus nicotine replacement will be nicotine-free at 6 months compared to individuals that are just on varenicline. Break that down to real numbers, number needed to treat. That's a number needed to treat of 10. So as you can see, if you're just doing nicotine patch, well, then it's a number needed to treat about 1 in 20. You're doing bupropion, the number needed to treat using varenicline instead is 1 in 15. You're using varenicline plus nicotine replacement therapy compared to just varenicline alone, now your number needed to treat's down to 1 in 10. Those are fantastic numbers. And the guideline goes on and talks about e-cigarettes. It is 2020 after all. We should talk about e-cigarettes. Everyone wants to talk about them. What does this guideline say? Well, it says, we admit we don't have any really good evidence on this, or no direct evidence, meaning we don't have any evidence in which trials use e-cigarettes and they use varenicline, and those were the two groups. But they have indirect evidence, which means in one trial they use e-cigarettes versus, I don't know, placebo, and in another trial they use varenicline versus, I don't know, placebo, and then they took the indirect evidence. They took indirect evidence of those patients in the e-cigarettes in one trial and the varenicline in the other trial, and then they smashed them together and made like a pseudo-false trial. It's not a really good way to do evidence by any means, or a good way to do studies by any means, but it is a way to do studies and kind of look at or cross-compare the effectiveness of medications. It's just less than ideal. But in the indirect evidence, varenicline still won out, but this is of low certainty because, as you can imagine, the evidence is of low certainty. And speaking of low certainty, what about the patients that are of low certainty that they want to stop smoking? The patients that say, no, listen, doc, I know I've tried to quit. It's just not really for me. I've thought about quitting, but I just can't quit. I can't quit. I'm addicted to them. I don't care what you say. I can't quit. To me, this was huge. And maybe one of the biggest recommendations, one of the biggest points in this guideline that I personally took away. Because until I read this, I always waited until the person was ready to stop smoking. Until they came to me and said, hey, I'm ready to stop smoking now. But in studies where people could not stop or were not interested in stopping, those started on varenicline were more likely to stop smoking. My mind was blown. And the evidence on this gives a strong recommendation with moderate certainty in the estimated effects. In fact, when you look at it, it looks like if you gave varenicline or you gave nothing, 173 more per thousand smokers were able to stop smoking at 6 months after starting varenicline, despite the provider not waiting for affirmation of readiness. Meaning a number needed to treat of coming up on 1 in 5. 1 in 5 individuals will be smoking free at 6 months, despite them saying, yeah, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to quit smoking. 1 in 5 will be smoke free at 6 months. This is huge and points to the fact that we need to be bringing this up with our patients. If our patients have any even doubt, even twitch, even of like, oh, I'd really like to stop smoking, but you know me, I just can't. Unless they are a diehard confirmed, I don't care what you give me because I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to fill the medication. I don't want to quit smoking. Then varenicline should probably be prescribed. And that is game changing. And finally, let's look at a couple special classes of individuals. What about those individuals with substance abuse disorders, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, bipolar? What about those individuals? In those people, can we start them on varenicline, or should we use, I don't know, a nicotine patch or something else? Because as we all know, that there's these neuropsychiatric disorders and effects, and it's going to make you way worse in the future, right? Well, let me just read right from the guideline where it says, The box warning regarding possible neuropsychiatric adverse events for both varenicline and bupropion stemmed from case reports and post-marketing surveillance, as no randomized control trials found evidence for these events, and early observations suggested no significant increase in neuropsychiatric adverse events with pharmacotherapy compared with placebo, even among patients with pre-existing mental illness. To summarize, with moderate certainty, compared with nicotine patches, varenicline may result in a large benefit for nicotine absence, and compared with nicotine patches, varenicline would likely result in little to no difference in the significant adverse effects. And their last recommendation is, last but not least, it is if you have the choice to give either 6 to 12 weeks of varenicline or greater than 12 weeks of varenicline, then a strong recommendation with moderate certainty in the evidence suggests that you should go with a longer dose of medication. And with that, we have wrapped up these guidelines in a quick little summary. So let's move on to some other articles, shall we? All right, a few more articles and I will wrap up this podcast as I've closed every single one before it. The next article is safety and efficacy of apixaban versus enoxaparin for preventing post-operative venous thromboembolism in women undergoing surgery for gynecological malignant neoplasm, a randomized clinical trial. Whew! Here's the deal. Following surgery for gynecologic malignancies, the American Society of Clinical Oncology has developed guidelines for postoperative VTE prophylaxis, and they recommend that almost everyone gets 1 month of subcutaneous low molecular weight heparin. But is this really needed? And let's be serious. Patients hate giving themselves shots. One of my favorite things to do on patients who are supposed to be giving themselves daily shots is to look at their stomach. I rarely find the physical exam is actually that helpful, except for when you look at the stomach and there's no bruising on it, you know that they're not actually giving the medication. In this randomized controlled trial of 28 days of subcutaneous enoxaparin versus oral apixaban in 400 women undergoing open or minimally invasive surgery for gynecological cancer, the primary endpoint of the study was the incidence of major bleeding events occurring during the treatment phase and in the 30 days after treatment. Major bleeding was defined as fatal bleeding or symptomatic bleeding in critical organ areas, or the need for 2 units of transfusion of packed red blood cells. Those are quite different endpoints. Major bleeding that causes death, or you just get 2 units of packed red blood cells. But that's what they chose. Now, major bleeding was limited to 1 participant in each group. The incidence of clinically relevant non-major bleeding, things like hematoma, bruising, epistaxis, and vaginal bleeding, was pretty similar between the 2 groups, 12 in apixaban and 19 in enoxaparin. And VTE occurred in right about 3 patients per group. Overall, this was pretty equal. In the apixaban group, satisfaction was greater, though, because it's a pill and they weren't giving themselves injections. In fact, 100% satisfaction versus only 60% satisfaction with enoxaparin. The haters to this study will say that it was underpowered because the incidence of venous thromboembolism and bleeding events was so small. It was so much less than they anticipated. And I will say that they are not wrong. They wanted to be able to tell a difference of 6% between the 2 groups. But overall, there was only 31 cases of bleeding in both groups, which is only a 7% total of the whole population. So to tell a difference of 6% is really not possible unless the apixaban group didn't have any events whatsoever. That would be the only way that you'd be able to have this a 6% difference when only 7% of the population actually had an event. So very low rates of the primary outcome was likely attributed to the 90% compliance rate that was seen in this trial. That's not what we see in real life. We know that people who have to give themselves injection are not that compliant in real life, or at least my patients are not that compliant in real life, and everyone I've talked to these patients are not that compliant in real life. But when you're doing a trial and when you're being called, and it just lends itself to more compliant individuals. Plus, sometimes they're getting paid. Overall, I think we are seeing this trend over and over and over again. The bans and trans seem to work for anticoagulation for VTE, whether you have cancer or you don't have cancer or you're following up from a malignant surgical cancer, it does not matter. The bands and trans, the dabigatran, the apixaban, the rivaroxaban, and the edoxaban are the way of the future when it comes to VTE prophylaxis and treatment. And with that, let's move on to the next article. And the next article is titled Primary Care Autism Screening and Later Autism Diagnosis. This was in Pediatrics 2020. We have screening instruments for autism spectrum disorder, such as the Modified Checklist for Autism in Toddlers, or the MCHAT. These, we would like to think that they're ideal. We would like to think that these catch everyone with autism ages 6, 12, and 18 months. What a great tool, and we can catch these children while they're young and get them started early on a treatment, right? Right? That's what we should do, right? But in this study, researchers examined the electronic medical record for 36,000 children who had 18-month or 24-month well child visits from 2013 to 2016. Of the children that were analyzed between 2013 and 2016, those same toddlers, those same little children, had their charts reviewed for autism diagnosis codes in 2019, when the children were almost 5 years old. When they reviewed the charts later in 2019, 67% of the children with autism had screened negative for autism at 18 and or 24-month old visits, which means the modified checklist for autism in toddlers, or the MCHAT score, has a sensitivity of 33% and a positive predictive value of only 18%. And that is a terrible screening test, my friends. But this is important to know, because parents might get a false sense of security. Don't get me wrong, having a child with autism is by no means the end of the world. But having a child with autism after having what you as a parent felt was a negative screening test for autism at their 18th and or 24-month follow-up visit would be probably a little shocking, to say the least, a little world-shattering for just a moment, because you thought, no, my child does not have autism. And then all of a sudden you follow it up later and you say, wait, what happened? You just told me that he didn't have autism at the visit when he was 18 months old, or she was 18 months old. And now you're telling me that they do have autism? I'm so confused. It's important that the parents know that these tests are nowhere near close to perfect. In fact, they're so far from perfect that the positive predictive value of 82% means way more children that tested negative for this ended up having autism than those individuals that tested positive with this screening test. Something that has to be discussed with the parent anytime we are doing screening tests on their children. And with that, let's move on to one more very fast article, and then this ship is sailing out to sea. Don't miss the boat. Don't miss the education. Here we go. Sound the horn. The last article is titled Clinical Targeting of HIV Capsid Protein with a Long-Acting Small Molecule. And I find this to be the most uplifting article that I've read in a long time, because we have many antiretroviral medications, but most of them require daily dosing. And just like the daily injections of Lovenox, this could be a problem, because if you just forget a dose, it's kind of like birth control. It's not nearly as effective. So, what if we had something that worked a lot longer? What if we had something that worked, oh, I don't know, every 6 months, you say? Well, the new HIV medication, GS-6207, which is now named lenacaptavir, might be the answer and is entering phase 2 and 3 studies. And it is a wonderful drug, a miracle drug for HIV that is dosed every 6 months. In a study of healthy participants, a single subcutaneous injection of lenacaptavir produced levels that exceeded the concentration needed to inhibit HIV for greater than 24 weeks. And in a separate study involving people with HIV, a single subcutaneous injection of lenacaptavir led to a decline in HIV RNA levels. And yes, these are not the endpoints that we ultimately care about. I mean, yes, we care about infection rates and everything else, but These are impressive numbers, and this is the start of a new drug that will change the world of HIV management. And with that, let's wrap this up like we've ended every podcast before it. Here we go. Quick recap. If you are taking care of a patient that smokes, which I think most of us are, then give varenicline. The numbers are really impressive when it comes to any other treatment. And if you have the option, give varenicline plus nicotine replacement therapy. Always go for longer, such as 12 weeks or greater. And unless they are diehard ready to just, there's no way I'm giving up my cigarettes from my bare bloody knuckles, then start varenicline. Number needed to treat for smoking cessation at 6 months is 1 in 5. Pretty much everyone should be started on varenicline. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, this was a practice changer for me, and hopefully it is for you as well. What about women that undergo gynecological malignant neoplasm surgery and they need VTE? Well, it appears that the bands in trans, this particular study, apixaban, is equal to enoxaparin. The low event rate means that we probably can't use this in practice at this time, but as we've seen with multiple other diseases and multiple other cancer origins and VTE prophylaxis and treatment, it appears the bands in trans, dabigatran, the apixaban, the rivaroxaban, the edoxaban are equal to injections and a whole lot less painful. And speaking of painful, can you imagine the pain and the mental anguish when you have been told, oh, no worry, your child does not have autism? The screening test, this modified checklist for autism and toddlers, the MCH hat, that MCHAT screening was completely negative at 18 or 24 months, and then finding out a few months or years later that your child does indeed have autism. The screening test is by no means 100%. In fact, 67%, almost 70% of the children that had autism screened negative at 18 and 24 months. It's just something that we need to educate our parents about, or maybe not even do the test. And with that, let's go to the last article that I talked about, which was a new drug that's going to be coming out every 6 months, hopefully. Lenacaptavir injections every 6 months for this HIV suppression. We are heading into new and improved times. Science is an amazing thing. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. There it is. Yep. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.